To me, always, speed is the key. I want to figure this all out so I can get to the writing. And once I have my 40 beats laid out and my plus or minus and greater than less than done on each card, I know I've done as much as humanly possible to prepare. And now I'm ready to put away my pushpins and cards and pens and start typing. Suddenly, typing will feel great. The work on the board is important, but it's a trick I play on myself, an exercise in storing moments, rhythms, scenes, and scene sequences in my brain. It allows me to play with these elements without commitment to any of them. I must always be willing to throw it all away as I begin the writing process. How many times have I gotten in there and started writing and dumped every preconceived notion of what I had? How many times have I fallen in love with a minor character that has risen to become one of the leads who wasn't even mentioned in the outline of my board? Well, lots is the answer. That's what happens. What the board will do for you is prepare the battlefield, allow you to test your theories, grind in certain notions, and minimize others. Final words on the subject. Truth is, when you write fade in, the board means nothing. But I hope the things I've tried to get across to you will still be burning in your brain and will stick with you. These are the necessity of hitting your act break on page 25. Hitting the midpoint, and all is lost, hard, and the need to have conflict in every scene. Even if these things are all that you remember as you get lost in your story, you'll be in great shape. These islands in a sea of uncertainty are important to keep in sight as you begin to write. And it's all designed to get you to the end. The blessing of having this handy guide up on the wall of your workroom is, if you do get lost, if you can't figure out what happens next, you can always go back to the board and get back on track. The worst thing that can happen in screenwriting is to not finish. Half-written screenplays never sell, that's for sure. And working out the board in advance is your best guarantee that this won't happen. Checking in with my secret weapon. Of course, when I'm really stuck, I call Mike Cheda. "Mike," I whine, "I don't know what happens when bad guys close in. Can you take a look?" I then email my notes to Mike and go have an expensive lunch up at the Eurotrash Cafe on Sunset Plaza, confident that someone is working on my project, even if it's not me. Mike is the one person I know in Hollywood who actually reads the material you send him and knows how to fix it. He will even give you detailed notes, and he's a real smart aleck, too, which I like. It keeps me on my toes. But you know you're in trouble when you come back from your expensive lunch, having flirted with a Euro hostess and feeling very good, and you call Mike, and the first thing out of his mouth is, "You're kidding, right?" If you too want to reach Mike Cheda for screenwriting advice, you can do so on the internet at www.mikecheda.com, where for a fee of $500, Mike will read and analyze your screenplay. I think this is the bargain of the century, and I'm always telling him to up his price. He should be charging $5,000 per script, if you ask me. A story about Mike in Creative Screenwriting magazine referred to him as the Dr. Phil of screenwriting. Another understatement. To me, he'll always be the guy who taught me everything I know. For free. Summary. So now you know everything about your movie that you need to start writing your screenplay. If you have held off long enough on your movie idea to do the steps I have suggested, you're ready to write Fade In and begin. Are you excited? You should be, but let's just make sure you're set by going over the Get Ready for Your Deep Sea Dive checklist. 1. You have come up with a great idea. And I mean it's killer. You have a killer title, a killer logline, and you've tested it on friends and strangers, and every one of them can't wait to see your movie. 2. You have done your homework on genre. You've figured out what your movie is most like and screened every relevant Hollywood film in the past 20 years. You know what the filmmakers did right, what they did wrong, and more importantly, how your movie will be a step forward and be the same thing, only different. And you are convinced you've got something new. 3. You have figured out the perfect hero to take this journey. This is the character that offers the most conflict in that situation, has the longest way to go emotionally, and is the most demographically pleasing. And you've given your hero a primal goal, and a real bad guy who wants to stop him from achieving it. 4. Finally, you have beat out your movie using the BS2, and have put up all those great scenes on the board, tried many ideas, themes, and storylines, and have whittled it all down to 40 actual scenes, with each scene indicating its emotional change from beginning to end, plus or minus, and what the conflict is in each, greater than, less than. Man, are you ready? What's stopping you? While you go off and start writing your screenplay, we'll be waiting for you and rooting you on. We'll be the guy up on the dock that feeds the oxygen tube down to you, the deep sea diver as you descend into the depths of your subconscious mind. Make sure that in your life you too have similar support from friends and loved ones. Because as you drop into the depths of your story, trying to capture the thoughts and the feelings you need to accomplish your mission, you have to trust that those up in the real world are supporting you and are watching your back. It's weird down there. You'll see all manner of wondrous and strange things, be amazed by what you're capable of handling, and surprised by how great an experience it can be. But it's also dangerous. Doubt and anxiety will plague you. And like the bends, it will cause you to see fearful things that aren't even there. In order to get through to the end, you've got to have someone back on land that you trust, that's supporting and nurturing your effort. Whether you have that situation in your life or not, we'll be up on the dock waiting for you and wishing you well. We who write screenplays want to see you win and win big time. And we know exactly what you're going through down there and want you not to worry. So as you descend into the murk, as ready as you'll ever be, we wish you good hunting. And while we wait for you to come up, we'll kill a little time and talk about some fun things in screenwriting. Good luck, and Godspeed, screenwriter. Exercises. 1. Take the beat sheet from one of the movies you have screened from your genre and write the beats on index cards. Put the cards up on the board, or if you have not gone to Staples yet, try the portable version. 2. Find several scenes from your favorite movies and break them down according to their plus or minus values. How does the scene start emotionally? How does it end emotionally? Are these opposite emotional beats? 3. Now take the same scenes and test them for greater than, less than conflict. Who or what are the opposing forces on each side of the conflict? Who wins? Do your favorite scenes in these movies have the most conflict? Is bigger conflict better? Chapter 6. The Immutable Laws of Screenplay Physics. The real inspiration for this book started with one simple desire. I had a whole bunch of snappy rules for screenwriting, and I wanted to get credit for coining them. There, I said it. These are little ironclad laws that my screenwriting buddies and I have collected over the years, and I love them. It's because, to me, screenwriting is a science as much as an art. It's quantifiable. The rules that govern it are constants, and in some cases eternal. See Joseph Campbell. Like any study of the craft of storytelling, these truths become apparent as you watch movie after movie. And when one of these immutable laws is suddenly clear to you, the urge to yell, "Eureka!" is overwhelming. You want to plant your flag on it and claim it as your own. Of course it's not. These laws can't be discovered. They're truths that existed way before you or I came along. Yet every time another one pops into my lexicon, I am thrilled. I love these immutable laws of screenplay physics so much I wanted to make this whole book about nothing else. But common sense intervened. To get to the good part, I had to explain the screenwriting process from idea to execution in order for anyone to understand what I was talking about. And aren't you glad I did? But even though this is the dessert part for me, the fun, the raison d'etre of the whole operation, there are some of you out there who will still want to pee on my Pop-Tarts. Yes, there will be a few among you who will doubt my rules. You are the type of person who bucks the system, who wants to make your own rules, thank you very much. When told that you can't do something, you want to do it all the more. You know, a screenwriter. To those of you who doubt me, bravo. But at least let me show off a little bit here. Let me run amok, ego-wise, and tell you how smart I am to have uncovered these things before you go and stomp them dead. And try to remember the value of knowing these is so that you can override them. Before Picasso could dabble in cubism, he had to become a master of basic drawing. It gave him credibility and authority. So for you budding Picassos, a few of my screenwriting basics. Save the cat. I found that Save the Cat The title of this book and the screenwriting law it denotes is amazingly controversial. Though many screenwriters I've shown this manuscript to are impressed with its premise, a few are horrified with this one idea and find it my least best thought. Many think my example of Save the Cat found in Sea of Love, as detailed in the introduction of this book, is old-fashioned and the worst piece of advice in an otherwise helpful primer. Not only that, they find the idea of making the hero likable to be cloying and dull, an exercise in kissing up to the audience. To review, Save the Cat is the screenwriting rule that says the hero has to do something when we meet him so that we like him and want him to win. Does this mean that every movie we see has to have some scene in it where the hero gives a buck to a blind man in order to get us on board? Well, no, because that's only part of the definition. So, on behalf of my hypercritical critics, allow me a mid-course addition. The adjunct to Save the Cat says, the screenwriter must be mindful of getting the audience in sync with the plight of the hero from the very start. To explain what I mean, let's take a look at a movie that definitely does not try to kiss up to the audience, Pulp Fiction. Scene 1 of Pulp Fiction basically is where we meet John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson. These are the heroes. They are also drug-addicted hitmen with really bad haircuts. Quentin Tarantino does a very smart thing when we meet these two potentially unlikable guys. He makes them funny and naive. Their discussion about the names of McDonald's hamburgers in France is hilarious and sort of childlike. We like these guys from the jump, even though they're about to go kill someone. We are with them. In a sense, Tarantino absolutely follows the STC rule. He knows he has a problem. These two guys are about to do something despicable. And in the case of Travolta, he will become one of the main characters of the film, a guy the audience must like in order to root for him. Well, after meeting these two crazy knuckleheads, we do like them. They're funny. Instead of risking the audience's goodwill by making them existential hard-asses without a soul, screenwriter Tarantino, in his own way, makes them sort of huggable. Save the Cat. The problem of making anti-heroes likable or heroes of a comeuppance tale likable enough to root for can also be finessed with STC. The immutable laws of screenplay physics tell us that when you have a semi-bad guy as your hero, just make his antagonist worse. A little further on in the introductory scene of Pulp Fiction, Tarantino does just that. Before he and Samuel Jackson reach the door of their victims, Travolta raises the specter of their boss and tells a story of how an underling like himself was thrown out of a window for giving the boss's wife a foot massage. This is just another example of a great STC trick. When your hero is slightly damaged goods or even potentially unlikable, make his enemy even more horrible. If you think Travolta is bad, well, look at the boss. Travolta is a doll compared to that guy. And bingo, the scales of whom we like versus whom we hate are adjusted to perfect balance. Let the rooting begin. The problem of unlikable heroes even occurs in nice family films. My favorite Save the Cat example, and one that I repeat way too often, comes from the Disney movie Aladdin. When developing this hit film, Disney found they had a real problem with the likability of the main character. Go back and read the source material. Aladdin, as described in the original stories, is kind of a jerk, spoiled, lazy, and to make matters worse, a thief. Thank God Disney had Terry Rossio and Ted Elliott on their team. Rossio and Elliott are, to me, the two best screenwriters working in Hollywood today. And so unsung. Where is their publicist? What these two crafty writers did was give Aladdin an introduction that solved the problem and was a classic example of Save the Cat. In that $100 million-plus hit, the first thing we see Aladdin do is impishly steal food because, well, he's hungry. Chased by palace guards with scimitars all over the market square, a great way to introduce where we are too, by the way, Aladdin finally eludes them. Safe in an alley, he is about to chow down on his stolen pita when he spots two starving kids. And what a guy. Aladdin gives his falafel snack to them. Well, now we're with Aladdin, and even though he's not quite the original thieving layabout character, we're rooting for him, because Rossio and Elliot took time to get us in sync with the plight of this unlikely hero. We want to see him win. The point of all this is care, though you don't have to have a scene in every movie where the hero literally saves a cat, helps an old lady across the street, or gets splashed by water at the street corner to make us love him. You must take the audience by the hand every time out and get them in sync with your main character and your story. You must take time to frame the hero's situation in a way that makes us root for him, no matter who he is or what he does. If you don't, if you go the Laura Croft route and assume we'll like your main character just 'cause, you're not doing your job. And even though some movies do this and get away with it, it doesn't make it okay or good and careful storytelling. Am I off the hook on this now, fellow screenwriters? The Pope in the Pool. The Pope in the Pool is more of a trick than a rule, but it's a fun one that I love to talk about and one that I see done on screen all the time. It is also one of the first insights passed on to me by Mike Chitta, script master. Your problem is how to bury the exposition. Exposition is backstory or details of the plot that must be told to the audience in order for them to understand what happens next. But who wants to waste time on this? It's boring. It's a scene killer. It's the worst part of any complicated plot. So what's a good and caring screenwriter to do? Mike Chitta told me about a script he once read called The Plot to Kill the Pope by George England, which did a very smart thing. It's basically a thriller, and the scene where we learn the details of the vital backstory goes like this. Representatives visit the Pope at the Vatican. And guess where the meeting takes place? The Vatican pool. There, the Pope, in his bathing suit, swims laps back and forth while the exposition unfolds. We, the audience, aren't even listening, I'm guessing. We're thinking, I didn't know the Vatican had a pool. And look, the Pope's not wearing his Pope clothes. He's in his bathing suit. And before you can say, where's my miter, the scene's over. The Pope in the Pool. The Pope in the Pool comes up all the time, but I've written one scene using this trick that I'm really proud of. It was in a script called Drips that Colby Carr and I wrote and sold to Disney. A comedy, duh. Drips is about two dumb plumbers who are tricked into an oil-stealing plot that is to unfold beneath the streets of Beverly Hills. Suckered into the heist by a beautiful girl, Plum and Plumber are invited to the girl's boss's house, where the bad guy will explain the heist and essentially lay out the plot of the movie. He will describe how our two plumbers will be required to tap into an old oil well beneath the house and connect the runoff to the sewers beneath the city, which inevitably lead to the sea, and the bad guy's waiting oil tanker. Trust me, it's possible. And yet we risk the audience's attention as we force them to sit through this potentially joy-killing exposition. Our solution? The Pope in the Pool. In the scene before the meeting starts, we show our two doofus heroes having an iced tea drinking contest to show off for the beautiful girl whom they both like. By the time the meeting begins, they both need to pee, really badly. The humor of the scene comes from them sitting there, legs crossed, trying to concentrate on the bad guy's PowerPoint demonstration, while all manner of pee-inducing images are seen around them. Out the window, lawn sprinklers go on, and the neighbor's dog takes a big relieving whiz on a bush. And in the room, the girl pours a nice, tall glass of iced tea for herself from a crystal pitcher. Seeing these things, our two heroes are going slowly cross-eyed with discomfort, all while the bad guy drones on with the vital heist information. We got the information across, and it's hilarious. In the Austin Powers films, Mike Myers has done us one better by naming a character Basil Exposition, Michael York, whose sole purpose is to tell the boring backstory to the British super spy and us. Every time Basil appears, we know we're going to get a dose of elucidation, but revel in the fact that they know we know it's boring and have made light of that fact. There are dozens of examples of the Pope in the Pool, and now that you are aware of it, if you weren't already, you can come up with new ways to bury the backstory. Whether it's the two funny guards seen in Pirates of the Caribbean, where we get the lowdown on Jack Sparrow, or the batting cage scene in a thriller like A Clear and Present Danger, the Pope in the Pool gives us something to look at that takes the sting out of telling us what we need to know, and does so in a lively and entertaining way. Good trick. Thanks, Mike Chitta. Double Mumbo Jumbo. Double Mumbo Jumbo is a favorite. It is also a rule you and I can't break, even though we see it broken all the time. I propose to you that for some reason, audiences will only accept one piece of magic per movie. It's the law. You cannot see aliens from outer space land in a UFO and then be bitten by a vampire and now be both aliens and undead. That, my friends, is double mumbo jumbo. Yet, despite the fact that it throws a big ol' sabot into the machinery of the audience's brain, even though Double Mumbo Jumbo is logically wrong, it's done all the time. My favorite example is Spider-Man. Why is it that you went willingly to see this movie? It became a big hit, and yet, when it comes on cable, you don't want to see it again. Can't be the actors. We love Toby and Kirsten and Willem. Can't be the special effects. Swinging through the city on a spider web is cool. I propose that our interest vanishes around the middle of the movie when the Green Goblin first appears. That's where I always lose interest anyway. Why? Double Mumbo Jumbo. The makers of Spider-Man ask us to believe two pieces of magic in one movie. Over here on this side of town, a kid is bitten by a radioactive spider and endowed with superhero powers that combine nuclear fusion and arachnia. Okay, I'll buy that. But then over on the other side of town, Willem Dafoe is getting a whole other set of magic powers from an entirely different source when a lab accident transmutes him into the Green Goblin. So, you're saying that we have a radioactive spider bite and a chemical accident? And both give one superpowers? I'm confused. They're straining my suspension of disbelief. They're breaking the reality of the world they asked me to believe in once already. How dare they? Like, say, the cat, when I see the DMJ rule violated, I get mad. It's sloppy. It's a product of moronic creativity. Yet in the world of comic books, you're sort of excused. Double Mumbo Jumbo is also in another big hit, one that doesn't get let off the hook because it's from a comic book. In M. Night Shyamalan's Signs, we are asked to believe that aliens from outer space have invaded Earth. Apart from the really embarrassing finale in which a super-intelligent alien is dispatched with a baseball bat, "Swing away, Meryl," is now my favorite bad line, the movie is about Mel Gibson's crisis of faith in God. Huh? I'd say proof of an alien intelligence outside our solar system sort of trumps all discussion about faith in God, don't you think? But M asks us to juggle both. And it's a mess. My guess is M started his script with his one piece of magic, aliens, crop circles, and realized we'd seen that. In an effort to make his alien movie different, he tried to make it meaningful. Okay, but in doing so, he also made it muddy. The minute aliens arrive, the problem of Mel Gibson's crisis of faith is, well, ridiculous. You want to see a miracle? Look out the window. Aliens have landed, Mel. Because what M is asking us to balance in our minds is a debate about whether or not God and little green men exist. Well, God and aliens don't mix. Why? Because it's two sets of different kinds of magic. It's double mumbo jumbo. And if you don't believe me, try substituting the word Allah for the word God and see if your brain doesn't melt. So unless you too have a hit movie in your back pocket or a comic book you must translate to screen, don't try it. Only one piece of magic per movie, please. It's the law. Lane Pipe. Minority Report, starring Tom Cruise, did it. So did Along Came Polly, featuring Ben Stiller and Jennifer Aniston. Each of these movies did something that risked failure. And once I point out their flaw, you will see that perhaps they did more than risk it. In my opinion, both these movies came up short because the filmmakers went long. They forgot one of the immutable laws of movie physics we screenwriters live by. Audiences can only stand so much pipe. What is pipe? And what is the risk of laying too much of it? Well, let's take a look at Minority Report, the big-budget movie based on yet another work by sci-fi writer Philip K. Dick. In death, Dick has become the go-to guy for source material that has resulted in such hits as Blade Runner and Total Recall. In Minority Report, the book is typically Dickian. But in this case, setting up the premise almost kills the story. Minority Report is about future crime, and we see exactly how this works in the opening scene of the film. A homicide is about to take place, and since Tom Cruise is in charge of the task force that monitors these future crimes, we see him spring into action and stop the murder. In the next scene, we jump to the politics involved and how this operation works. Tom, we learn, is under investigation by Colin Farrell. We even meet the three precognitives who lie in a tub of water and predict the future. We also see that in his personal life, Tom lost his child and has some kind of drug problem. We also meet Tom's mentor, Max von Sydow, whom we don't totally trust. Okay, all well and good, but By the time the writers lay out the pipe required to set up this story, I am personally exhausted. It's interesting, but what's the point? Where is this going? The story finally gets underway when Tom receives the latest future news, and lo, the criminal pegged is himself. Knowing that the precogs are never wrong, Tom must find out how and why this mistake has been made, and stop the murder that he supposedly will commit. The clock is running, and so are we. There's only one small problem. By the time this plot point happens, we are 40 minutes into the movie. It took 40 minutes to set up this story and explain to the audience what it's about. It took 40 minutes to get to the hook, which is a detective discovers he is the criminal. Say it with me now, fellow students. That's a lot of pipe. In Along Came Polly, we find the same problem. In order to get to risk-averse divorcee Ben Stiller falling in love with crazy girl Jennifer Aniston, the writer also has a lot of pipe to lay. We have to see Ben marry his first wife, follow them on their honeymoon, and watch as Ben catches her in the arms of their scuba instructor. Sure, it's funny, and we'll put up with a lot when it comes to any movie that Ben is in. We love Mr. S. But the screenwriter and director, same guy, the funny and talented John Hamburg, risks our attention by laying a ton of story points to get to the reason we came to see this movie. Ben Stiller dating Jennifer Aniston. In both Along Came Polly and Minority Report, the laying of all that pipe, a necessary thing to set up the story, risks our attention and I believe contributes to a lesser movie-going experience. By needing so much backstory to set up the movie, the whole story has been torqued out of shape. To be honest, laying pipe is something about which I'm hyper-aware, and in many cases I have stopped writing stories due to the pipe required to set them up. Blank Check has a little bit more pipe up front than I am comfortable with. There is way too much splainin' to do to get us to the point where our hero, Preston, walks into the bank with his blank check for $1 million. A lot of back and forth. A lot of pipe. It's not quite fatal, but almost. There's about a half a beat more movie in Act One than I like, and it risks the audience's patience. Get to it, I hear them screaming. And as screenwriters, we need to be aware of risking the attention spans of our audience. The point is, if you find yourself with a setup that takes more than 25 pages to introduce, you've got problems. We call it laying pipe. The audience calls it, I want my money back. Black Vet, a.k.a. Too Much Marzipan. When dealing with conceptual creativity, an offshoot of the double mumbo jumbo rule is a rule I call Black Vet. You often fall in love with certain elements of a movie idea and cling to them. You can't let go. You're Lenny in Of Mice and Men, and you're going to squeeze that little rodent to death. And usually when you find yourself in this situation, you must stop. This is when the Black Vet rule allows you to step back from the concept. What is Black Vet? Better to tell you where it came from. In the 1970s, comedian and now actor-writer-director Albert Brooks made several film parodies for Saturday Night Live. In one of his best, a piece that tweaked the nose of NBC and the silliness of network programming, Brooks did a hilarious fake promo for several upcoming shows that would be seen that fall on NBC. One of these was called Black Vet. In unctuous NBC Be There style, it showed a black actor who played a veterinarian cavorting with animals at his clinic. But this guy also has a past in the military. The punchline came when the narrator announced the name of the show and its fake promo line, Black Vet. He's a veteran and a veterinarian. Hilarious, but it is also so close to a real show on real TV. So much about the desperation of Hollywood types trying to squeeze 10 pounds of shit into a 5-pound bag that I found it to be brilliant, and I personally never forgot it. Black Vet is a joke, and yet you'd be surprised how often we creative folks get caught piling on our great concepts, like eating too much marzipan. A little goes a long way where ideas are concerned. And more does not always mean better. In my career, my favorite example of this came when I was working with my first writing partner, the quick-witted and entrepreneurial Howard Berkins. We were young and energetic writers with a lot of great ideas and a lot of bad ones. But Howard and I achieved early success and even earned our WGA cards while working together, a huge step forward for us both. Because we were working in TV, we had a TV series idea, and a good one, I thought. Set in the 1950s, it followed the adventures of a blacklisted private eye. We called the show Lefty, get it? Lefty referred to his political affiliation, but sounded tough and very 50s. Okay, but Howard and I killed the idea when Howard insisted we also make our hero left-handed. And maybe Howard suggested he could also be an ex-boxer, a left-handed ex-boxer, so he's a communist and an ex-boxer, and he's left-handed? I kept asking. And Howard thought that was great. Well, to my mind, it was pick one. To Howard, it was a matter of milking the idea for all it was worth. And while I usually trusted Howard's instinct on this stuff, Howard is brilliant when it comes to conceptualizing and a much smarter marketer than I just didn't get it. It was too much marzipan. It was black vet. What we had succumbed to was getting stuck on a good idea, and it's easy to do. You like that? Well, hell, you'll like it even more if I just add a couple more scoops of the same thing on top, right? Well, no. To this day, whenever I talk with my pal Howard, he insists he was right about Lefty. Me? It's a whistle I don't hear. Still. But it makes a great rule of screenwriting and creativity. Simple is better. One concept at a time, please. You cannot digest too much information or pile on more to make it better. If you do, you get confused. If you do, stop. Watch out for that glacier. Very often when bad guys are involved, they will be way off screen somewhere, far away from our hero, and closing in. Sometimes they close in so slowly, the noose tightens so lackadaisically, you want to yell at the screen, "Watch out for that glacier!" Well, I do anyway. That's how the danger's coming toward your hero. Slowly, 1 inch per year. That's how unthreatening your supposedly threatening horror is. And if you think this doesn't happen to the big boys as well as you and me, you're wrong. Slow danger happens to good movies all the time. Just check out Pierce Brosnan in Dante's Peak, one of two volcano movies that came out in 1997, presumably to cash in on all that Mount St. Helens buzz. And here's what Dante's Peak is about. See that volcano? It's going to blow any minute. That's it. And that's all it is. The volcano is about to erupt, and no one believes the handsome scientist, Pierce Brosnan. So, we sit there and wait for him to be right. We saw the trailer. Well, while we're waiting, at least we can look at Brosnan and think, yeah, Sean Connery was better. And check out Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak. Now, there's a dull movie. Basically, it's about a super Ebola virus that comes to the U.S. and Hoffman's attempt to find a cure. But while we're waiting, that virus is slowly, slowly, really slowly, headed our way. It's a Monster in the House movie, basically, but in Outbreak, they have to create the house by quarantining a small town and introducing us in thumbnail sketches to the people who live there, so we'll care if they die. Of course, we don't meet them until, like, page 75. But so what? We got to do something while we're waiting for this butterball to baste and for Dustin to catch an infected monkey, which, if I remember correctly, is the D or E plot of Outbreak. And, man, how did these guys get talked into this? It even happens in Westerns. In Open Range, Kevin Costner's and Robert Duvall's cowboy buddy gets killed by the bad guys on about page 20, at which point Kevin and Robert sit there on their horses and talk about the bad guys and how they're going to go get them. Yep, they sure should go get them. For about an hour and a half. If you ever wondered how the West was won, apparently it happened very slowly. See, even bright people think the slow encroaching danger of hot lava headed your way, oh, about by Thursday or so, we'll get our emotions stirring. But lo, it does not. Danger must be present danger. Stakes must be stakes for people we care about, and what might happen to them must be shown from the get-go, so we know the consequences of the imminent threat. If not, you are violating the watch out for that glacier rule. Here's a list of other glaciers that approach slowly or are too remote, unthreatening, or dull. An evil slinky. Snails armed with AK-47s. A foreclosure letter sent from Siberia. A homicidal one-legged grandmother. A herd of angry turtles. Locusts. Even if you have a catchy title, do not write movies with these bad guys. Okay, well, unless the locusts are biologically altered locusts that like to eat human flesh, then we'll talk. The Covenant of the Ark. The Covenant of the Ark is the screenwriting law that says every single character in your movie must change in the course of your story. The only characters who don't change are the bad guys. But the hero and his friends change a lot. And it's true. Although I hate the term arc because it's gotten so overused by development executives and how to write a screenplay authors, I do like what it stands for. Arc is a term that means the change that occurs to any character from the beginning, through the middle, and to the end of each character's journey. Another esty kind of term. But when it's done well, when we can chart the growth and change each character undergoes in the course of a movie, it's a poem. What you're saying in essence is, this story, this experience is so important, so life-changing for all involved, even you, the audience. It affects every single person that is in its orbit. From time immemorial, all good stories show growth and track change in all its characters. Why in this? I think the reason that characters must change in the course of a movie is because if your story is worth telling, it must be vitally important to everyone involved. This is why setups and payoffs for each character have to be crafted carefully and tracked throughout. I don't know why, but Pretty Woman comes to mind as a good example of this. Everybody arcs in Pretty Woman. Richard Gere, Julia Roberts, Laura San Giacomo, even the mentor figure, Hector Elizondo, are touched by the experience of this love story and transformed because of it. Everyone but the bad guy, Jason Alexander, who learns exactly zero. Pretty Woman is one of hundreds of carefully crafted, successful movies in which this rule applies. All the really good movies do this. Ones that you remember, that make you laugh and cry, the ones that you want to see a second time. Hint, hint. In a sense, stories are about change, and the measuring stick that tells us who succeeds and who doesn't is seen in the ability to change. Good guys are those who willingly accept change and see it as a positive force. Bad guys are those who refuse to change, who will curl up and die in their own juices, unable to move out of the rut their lives represent. To succeed in life is to be able to transform. That's why it's the basis not only of good storytelling, but also the world's best-known religions. Change is good because it represents rebirth, the promise of a fresh start, the covenant of the Ark. And don't we all want to believe in that? Don't we all want to jump into the swim of life after seeing a good movie? Don't we want to get out of our ruts, try something new, and be open to the healing power of change after experiencing a movie in which everybody arcs? Yes, we do. Everybody arcs. That's one of the slogans I have written on a yellow post-it note and have stuck to the top of my iMac computer whenever I am writing a screenplay. And before I sit down to write, I make notes on how all my characters are going to arc by charting their stories as they are laid out on the board, with the milestones of change noted as each character progresses through the story. It is a must that you do the same. If your script feels flat, if you are getting the sense that something's not happening in the story, do a quick Covenant of the Ark check and see if you need to do more work on making everybody change and grow and transform. Everyone, that is, except the bad guy. Keep the press out. Here's where I get to show off, big time. You see, I learned this next lesson from Steven Spielberg, personally. Oh yeah, we worked together, and it was one of the most educational experiences of my career. But in terms of the immutable laws of screenwriting, that's the guy who really should write the book. I can only paraphrase. To wit, keep the press out. The rule I learned from Steven Spielberg was taught to me while we were developing a screenplay Jim Hagen and I had sold to Amblin called Nuclear Family. The premise of this movie is a family camps out one night on a nuclear dump site and wakes up the next day with superpowers. Nuclear Family is a wish fulfillment comedy. Each family member has a need that their superpower quenches. Dad, an ad exec, gets the power to read minds, and thus leaps ahead of his rat-fink nemesis at work. Mom, a housewife, gets the power of telekinesis and becomes a supermom who can move objects with her mind. Teen son becomes the Flash and is suddenly his high school's star halfback. And teen daughter, forever behind in her schoolwork, gets a superbrain and is now able to ace her SATs. It's a fun, special effects-laden fantasy. But it has a message, too. In the end, each of them gives up their powers. Being successful, they find, is not as important as being a family. And yet, in the development process, we wanted to explore every option. When one of us, me, I think, foolishly pitched that maybe we should have these powers discovered by the media and to have the family swarmed by the news networks, Steven Spielberg said no, and he told us why. You'll notice that there are no news crews in E.T., the story of an extraterrestrial creature who comes to Earth and into the lives of a similar cul-de-sac-dwelling family. Sure, you've got a really good reason for a news crew. They've caught one, a real live alien. and it's right there for everyone to see. But in rewrites with the screenwriter, Melissa Matheson, Spielberg discovered that it blew the reality of the premise to invite the press in. By keeping it contained among the family and on the block, by essentially keeping the secret between them and us, the audience, the magic stayed real. When you think about it, to bring the press into E.T. would indeed have ruined it. The term breaking the fourth wall springs to mind. That is the phrase that means violating the gossamer beneath the proscenium arch that separates the play from the audience. To bring the press into our little drama would have done the same. Of course, this is what separates the Spielbergs from the rest of us, including the Shyamalans. Keep the press out is a rule you won't see violated in any DreamWorks film. But in M. Night Shyamalan's Signs, there's that darn movie again. The rule is violated and I think suffers because of it. Hold up in their Pennsylvania farmhouse, Mel Gibson's family is besieged by aliens. First the crop circles, then aliens arrive and try to break into Mel's house. And do what? We're not sure. Night of the Living Dead-like. So, while we're waiting for the attack, Mel and his family put on their tinfoil hats. God, what a movie. And watch TV. There on CNN, news of other aliens landing all over the world is reported. There's even some spooky footage of one such alien invading a children's birthday party in South America. And all that's interesting, but so what? What does it have to do with the drama of Mel trying to protect his family from the aliens that are swarming his house? I think it even makes their situation less desperate. They're no longer alone with this problem. Everyone's dealing with it. Like in the E.T. example, bringing the press into our secret Rexit. And it took me as an audience member out of the story. The point is, bring the press in with care. Unless it's about the press, unless your movie involves a worldwide problem and we follow stories with characters all over the world, and it's important for them all to know about each other, take a tip from me and Steven Spielberg. Keep the press out. Summary. So now you know some basics. And if you're like me, you want to know more and make up others as you go on. These are little eurekas that one experiences after watching a truckload of movies over the years. Suddenly you realize why things are done, what that scene really was for, and it makes you feel like a genius. Suddenly you're in on the tricks of screenwriting and have the experience of actually opening up the back of the Swiss watch and seeing how the gears are put together. So that's how that works, you suddenly think. You feel like you're learning the magician's secrets. Once you see these little tricks, the urge to put a label to them can't be far behind. This is why Save the Cat, The Pope in the Pool, Black Vet, and Keep the Press Out are memorable, to me anyway, and vital to be so. Yes, it's good, slangy fun. It's also a way not to forget what you've learned. And when you catch yourself drifting into a mistake or pushing up against a rule you'd like to break, these pithy little lessons give you an instant assessment on the pros and cons of minding or breaking the law. How many times have I caught myself drifting into one or more of these errors during the course of creating and writing a screenplay? Well, many. But the point of all this is to learn shortcuts to save time. Screenwriting is like solving a puzzle over and over. You get faster with practice. The more stories you break, the more outlines you beat out to their completion, the more screenplays you tag with the end, the better you get. These shortcuts are essential time savers. Exercises. 1. Name a movie hero that is unlikable. Did the creators of the movie do anything to deal with this? What new Save the Cat tricks can be used to make a hero likable, but not so phony baloney that we reject the device? 2. Find examples in other movies that use the Pope in the Pool. Does burying the exposition hurt or enhance your understanding of what's going on in the plot? 3. Fix Spider-Man. Let's say you don't have to follow the storyline that was created in the Marvel comic book Stan Lee created. What changes would you make to the screenplay that could eliminate its double mumbo-jumbo? 4. Since you liked M. Night Shyamalan's Signs, and think that I am out of my mind for not liking it, email me at the address found at the end of Chapter 1 and explain M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable to me, a movie so preposterous it makes Signs look like Battleship Potemkin. But remember, I've been working on my argument, and I am still ticked about not getting my $10 back from the theater. Chapter 7. What's wrong with this picture? You've made it. Congratulations. You've followed my advice, you've done the prep, you've hit your marks like a pro, and you've finally written the end. And whether you've got 90 pages or 130, you've accomplished what you set out to do. You've written a draft of a movie. You are amazing. So, before going on any further, let's bask for a moment in the glory of your success. Finishing a screenplay separates you from 5 out of 10 would-be screenwriters who only talk about writing their movie ideas. You have increased your odds of success immeasurably by doing the work, and whether it's your first script or your 21st, you have one more notch on your belt in a never-ending shootout with your creative demons. You've not only written a screenplay, you've gotten better at the job, and each one you write makes you better still. Me? I've written or co-written 75 screenplays, including TV scripts. And when I compare the ones I wrote initially to the ones I'm writing now, I can see real growth in my skills. I can always get better at this. And as long as I maintain the attitude that the next script will be my best yet, and keep being excited about the process, I know I can't fail. But back to you. You finished. And yet even though you're a proud parent, you're starting to have a few nagging doubts about this creation of yours. Some parts of your script don't work, you know that, and some parts you think secretly might be a train wreck. But having put your script aside for about a week, which I recommend, longer if you can stand it, you now come back to that glorious hatchling, read it over from start to finish, and are suddenly struck dumb. It's awful. Characters are flat. Nothing happens, or happens so slowly you can't believe a human being wrote it and not some mental patient. What were you thinking? You're not done. You haven't even started. What's worse, now that you know the awful truth, now that you realize how bad you are at this, you don't even want to keep going. You've gone from the high of mountaintop megalomania to the depths of self-loathing. Am I getting the basic roller coaster ride? Well, fear not. It always happens. You've got a ways to go, but before you jump off the Hollywood sign, take a breath. There's a way to prop up this puppy again and get you back on your megalomaniac way. I can help you pinpoint and fix some of your rough spots. And it's really not all that hard. It's just a matter of being honest in your assessment and willing to do the work to fix all the problems. So here are typical trouble spots that others have faced, long before you came along, that may help in your rewrite. The hero leads. A common mistake in a lot of rough drafts is the problem of the inactive hero. It's often hard to spot, especially if you've done everything else right. You've gone out of your way to thoroughly plot your screenplay. Every beat moves the story forward. But somehow you forgot to inform your lead. Your hero is being dragged through the story, showing up when he's supposed to, but for no reason. Your hero seems unmotivated. His goal, vague. The driving force that should be guiding him is MIA. Imagine what it would be like if a detective in a murder mystery acted this way. We'll call him Johnny Entropy, because he's an existential layabout who has no motivation and can't be paid to care. Johnny shows up, he goes through the motions of the case, but he doesn't want to. He never seeks clues. They're just given to him. He has no goals. He exists, but he doesn't know why. Johnny's motto is, "What's the point? We're all going to die someday anyway." Does this describe your hero? Well, if so, you've got to fix it, because if there's one thing we know for sure, it's the truism that the hero must be proactive. It's the law. If he's not, he's not a hero. Here's a checklist to see if your lead needs more oomph. 1. Is your hero's goal clearly stated in the setup? Is what your hero wants obvious to you and to the audience? If not, or if you don't know what your hero's goal is, figure it out. And make sure that goal is spoken aloud and restated in action and words throughout the story. 2. Do clues of what to do next just come to your hero, or does he seek them out? If it all happens too easily for your hero, something's wrong. Your hero cannot be handed his destiny. He must work for it at every step. 3. Is your hero active or passive? If the latter, you have a problem. Everything your hero does has to spring from his burning desire and his deeply held need to achieve his goal. If it can't be bothered or can get to that burning desire mañana, you've got Hamlet. Fine if you're Shakespeare. Bad if you're writing for Vin Diesel. 4. Do other characters tell your hero what to do, or does he tell them? Here's a great rule of thumb. A hero never asks questions. The hero knows and others around him look to him for answers, not the other way around. If you see a lot of question marks in your hero's dialogue, there's a problem. The hero knows. He never asks. My guess is that if any of the above rings true, you have an inactive hero on your hands. And scripts with inactive heroes lay there like a lox, so fix it. Give your hero a little kick in the butt and tell him to get in the game. Come on, let's see some leadership. That's what heroes do. Talking the plot. Another problem found in poorly executed screenplays is talking the plot, and it's a dead giveaway that the writer is green. The characters will walk in the scenes and say, "Well, you're my sister, you should know," and "This sure isn't like the time I was the star fullback for the New York Giants until my accident." This kind of dialogue is, say it with me, bad, and yet I completely understand why it's in there. You have backstory and plot to explain, and there's no way to say it, so you resort to having your character say it for you. And it sucks. It's one of those guaranteed to have your script thrown across the room by the reader things. The reason it makes the hair on the back of our necks stand up is that it's unreal. Who talks like that? You've forgotten that your characters don't serve you, they serve themselves. They should walk into each scene with their own goals and say what's on their minds, not yours. You must reveal who they are and what they want, their hopes, dreams, and fears, by how they say it as much as what they say. Good dialogue tells us more about what's going on in its subtext than on its surface. Subtle is better, and talking the plot is like using a sledgehammer. It's overkill. An adjunct to this rule of bad dialogue is show, don't tell, another of the most frequent mistakes found in newbie screenplays. You can say more about a relationship in trouble by seeing a husband eye a pretty young thing as he and his wife are walking down the street than by 3 pages of dialogue about how their marriage counseling sessions are going. Movies are stories told in pictures. So why would you resort to telling us when you can show us? It's so much more economical. You want to make sure the audience knows about a guy's New York Giants past? Show team pictures on the wall of his apartment. Give him a limp from the accident that ended his career, but only if it's germane. Sneak it in with subtle references. Want to make sure we know a fight has occurred between two people? Have them talk about anything but the fight. If handled right, the audience will get it. They're a lot more perceptive than you think. By showing and not telling, you leave room for your characters to be at their best. That's being active, with their own separate agendas for being there, not yours. The truth is that movies are so much about what happens that we must learn about characters by what they do, not by what they say. As in life, character is revealed by action taken, not by words spoken. And in a good movie, information doesn't come out in dialogue. It comes out in the verve and forward motion of the story. You must get out all your wonderful plot and backstory on the fly. Or better yet, not at all. You should be more concerned with what's happening now than what happened before the story started. So when you feel yourself drifting into talking the plot, don't. And when you think you're talking too much, show. Don't tell. Make the bad guy badder. In addition to the idea that the hero leads is the rule that says the bad guy must be as bad as possible. Many times your hero will do everything he's supposed to. He'll be proactive. He'll seek out and overcome obstacles. He'll do amazing things, and still we're unimpressed. He's such a nobody. He's so average, so unheroic, so insignificant. We don't want to see nobodies on screen. We want to see heroes. If this seems familiar, then maybe it's not the hero, but his antagonist that's the problem. And there's an easy solution. Maybe you need to make the bad guy badder. This is a common first draft problem. I think it's because we want our hero to win so badly that we don't want to make it impossible for him to do so. But we cannot protect our hero from danger and challenge. We must throw a little more at him than he is able to take. And making the bad guy badder automatically makes the hero bigger. It's one of those immutable laws of screenwriting. Think about James Bond. What makes James Bond a super spy? Isn't the gadgets or the girls or the car? What makes him James Bond? His Goldfinger, Blofeld, and Dr. No. How dull would 007 be if his enemy was an evil accountant who was juggling the books down at the local bank? Where would the challenge be in that? Suddenly, the gadgets and the car and the charm aren't necessary. James can just do a quick skip trace on the internet and be done in time for martini hour. He needs someone bigger to play with to make his own heroism bigger. He needs an antagonist whose powers match his own. In many a well-told movie, the hero and the bad guy are very often two halves of the same person struggling for supremacy, and for that reason are almost equal in power and ability. How many movies can you name that have a hero and a bad guy who are two halves of the same persona? Think about Batman, Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson, Die Hard, Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman, and even Pretty Woman, Richard Gere and Jason Alexander. Aren't the hero and the bad guy of each of these movies the light and dark sides of the same person? Aren't they the positive and negative X-ray of one soul? And each has something the other wants, even if it's just an answer to what makes them the way they are. The point is that the hero and the bad guy are a matched set and should be of equal skill and strength, with the bad guy being just slightly more powerful than the hero because he is willing to go to any lengths to win. After all, the bad guy has given up on having family values by definition. This does not mean you make the bad guy impossible to beat, just a challenge that looks impossible. So if your hero and your bad guy are not of equal strength, make them so, but give the edge to the bad guy. By ratcheting up the power and invincibility of the bad guy, the hero will have to do more than we can admire. Making the bad guy just out of reach of the ability of the hero to defeat him elevates our hero. Turn, turn, turn. This is another of those slogans that I have written on a faded post-it note. It's been stuck above my desk for 20 years. It was the first piece of wisdom I ever heard about screenwriting, and I'll be damned if I know who told me. But this anonymous advisor has guided me ever since. The basis of the turn, turn, turn rule is the plot doesn't just move ahead, it spins and intensifies as it goes. It is the difference between velocity, a constant speed, and acceleration, an increasing speed. And the rule is, it's not enough for the plot to go forward, it must go forward faster, and with more complexity to the climax. If things happen in your movie but aren't interesting, then all you've got is a chase. They go here, they go there, but nothing about the chase provokes any activity behind the audience's eyeballs. We're just watching stuff happen, but nothing about it is engaging or humanly compelling. And that's, anybody, anybody? Bad. Right. Let's take, for example, a very loud and busy movie, The Cat in the Hat, starring Mike Myers. Apart from the fact that it's one of the more inappropriate kids' movies ever made, it's a great example of lots of stuff happening all over the place, tons of action without anything happening at all. It's kinetic eye candy with no forward motion. It's a chase with no stakes. They go here, they go there, but I don't give a damn and don't know why I'm watching. It proves the point that you can have lots of action and still not have a story. It moves forward, but there's no turn, turn, turn. More must be revealed along every step of the plot about your characters and what all this action means. To that end, you, the writer of this plot, must show how it affects your characters as you go along. You must show flaws, reveal treacheries, doubts, and fears of the heroes and threats to them. You must expose hidden powers, untapped resources, and dark motivations for the bad guys that the hero doesn't know about. Show facets of that spinning diamond of plot. Let the reflected light amaze the audience. The diamond cannot merely move across the screen. It must turn, turn, turn in order to truly dazzle us. Show us all of it. Let the light play off its many sides. Let's see some of that detail. The same goes for the speed of the plot. As the grip of the bad guy tightens around the hero, things happen faster. And the pressure exerted in the vice-like grip of the forces opposing the hero will finally explode in its Act 3 climax with a rush of energy and emotion. If you don't feel your plot intensifying as you make the midpoint turn and start heading for the finish, you have problems. Turn, turn, turn reminds us to accelerate and reveal all with verve as we move the plot forward. Turn, turn, turn tells us to make the plot more dynamic and less inert. So if your screenplay's plot feels in any way static or flat, try looking at it from its other angles and make it accelerate, not just move forward. Make it turn, turn, turn. The emotional color wheel. When they say a good movie is like a roller coaster ride, they mean that as an audience member watching the story unfold, your emotions have been wrung out. You've laughed, you've cried, you've been aroused, you've been scared, you've felt regret, anger, frustration, near-miss anxiety, and ultimately, breathtaking triumph. And when the lights come up, you walk out of the theater feeling absolutely drained. Whew! What a movie. Whether it's a comedy or a drama, wringing out the emotions of the audience is the name of the game. Making it an emotional experience using all the emotions is what it's about. Think why that is. We go to the movies not only to escape reality and to ultimately learn a little lesson about life, but to experience a dream state where life and its attendant emotions are recreated in a safe environment. Like a good dream, we must live the movie. We must run in place along with the hero in our sleep, clutch our pillows at the love scene, and hide under the covers during the breathtaking climax of the film to wake exhausted but fulfilled, wrung out, worked out, and satisfied. So, your movie doesn't have this. So what? So it's one note emotionally? If it's a comedy and it's funny all the way through, what's the problem? If it's a drama and it's tense from start to finish, that's all. What's wrong with that? Well, let's take a look at two filmmakers I never thought I'd reference in any how-to book. The Farrelly brothers. They write and direct comedies like Something About Mary, Shallow Hal, and Stuck on You, and are known for hilarious, ribald set pieces. But if you think all they are is funny, you're wrong. These guys work it emotionally. In each of their movies, they have scenes of great fear, scenes of intense longing, scenes of lust, scenes of human foible. Their movies work because they use every color in the emotional color wheel. It's not just one note funny. And you can do the same. If your script feels one note emotionally, go back and flesh it out using all the colors in the palette. Where's your lust scene? Where's your frustration scene? Where's your scary scene? And if you don't have these, take a scene that's just funny or just dramatic and try to play it for one of the missing colors. A good way to do this is to actually choose a color of each of the missing emotions and go back and tag certain scenes to change the emotional tone from one type to another. Take those scenes and use the same action, the same plus or minus, the same conflict and result, but play it for lust instead of laughs, jealousy instead of flat-out stare-down dramatic conflict. By varying the emotions you use, you'll create a much more rewarding experience for everyone. Don't believe me? Go and look at any Farrelly Brothers movie. Hi, how are you? I'm fine. Flat dialogue even happens to good movies. But your script will never be a movie if you have dull, lifeless repartee. And when you find yourself reading page after page of this placeholder talk, you know you're in trouble. You're bored. And that is, wait for it, bad, absolutely. Hi, how are you? I'm fine. Tells us just how boring flat dialogue can be, and what a waste of space it is. Flat dialogue is the kind that anyone can say, and odds are that if your script is full of lines that are right out of real life, that ring true, but ring dull, you're not working hard enough to make the characters come to life. Because odds are that if your dialogue is flat, so are the people speaking it. Engaging characters talk differently than you and I. They have a way of saying things, even the most mundane things, which raise them above the norm. A character's dialogue is your opportunity to reveal character and tell us who this person is as much as what he is saying. How someone talks is character and can highlight all manner of that character's past, inner demons, and outlook on life. Every time a character speaks is your chance to show that. If you don't think you have flat dialogue, try a simple trick I learned from Mike Chaita. After reading one of my early scripts, he broke the news to me. Your characters all talk the same. Well, naturally, I was insulted. I was ticked. And young bullhead that I was, I did not believe Mike Chaita. What did he know? Then Mike showed me this simple bad dialogue test. Take a page of your script and cover up the names of the people speaking. Now, read the repartee as it goes back and forth between two or more characters. Can you tell who is speaking without seeing the name above the dialogue? The first time I tried it, there in Mike's office at Barry and Enright, I was stunned. Damn it, he was right. I couldn't tell one of my characters from the others. And then and there, I figured out something else, too. All the characters had my voice. In a good script, every character must speak differently. Every character must have a unique way of saying even the most mundane, "Hi, how are you? I'm fine," kind of chat. My best learning experience in this regard was an early draft of a script called Big Ugly Baby, an alien switched at birth comedy